Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you very much for coming along on Monday afternoon. And I'm very pleased to introduce Dr. Tony Curzon-Price, who arrived from London this morning. And so you can imagine he's very tired, but I'm very grateful that he's come along to talk to us today. And Tony is here in Japan for about a week in his capacity as the Chief Executive Officer of
Arithmatica,
which is calls itself the Silicon Math Company, which only Tony is able to tell you what that really means. But they produce logic which allows chips to be designed that do mathematical calculations very efficiently. So I believe that your technology is in the PlayStation 3, mm-hmm. which helps some of the 3D rendering.
So if you were on Second Life and the rendering was very slow on your computer, it was because you weren't using enough of the kind of logic we produce.
Right. So that's the professional reason for Tony to be here in Japan. However, Tony has another hat that he wears, which is as the head of opendemocracy.net, which is an independent website, and it has several articles every week about events and trends all around the world, often from people who are not professional journalists, but you also have some very highly respected professional journalists contributing articles. And you also recently started a podcast, which I tried to access, but iTunes didn't like it, I'm afraid. So today, Tony is going to talk about issues that confront organizations like Open Democracy as they try to provide continuous, high-quality content to people without directly charging them money for it. And so how is it possible to sustain such a website? All right, Tony, over to you.
Thank you very much, Jonathan, and thank you for coming. Thank you for the introduction. How many of you have done some economics courses? No, zero economics courses. Little bit. Okay. So before designing logic for chips and before getting into new media, I was an economist. So what I'm going to tell you is in a way, an economist's view of these new media business models. And there are a few graphs, but I hope that they explain rather than hide, and stop me if they don't make sense. And my hope is, what I hope I can convince you is there's the thinking the economics through of these new media business models has led me to a single conclusion, which is that to make new media content pay, to make it pay for itself, you have to build communities around it. That's the single point I'm going to try and convince you of today. It wasn't obvious to me when I started off. A lot of people talk about communities on the web. You've been spending time on Second Life, where, again, people talk about communities existing. But in some sense, people think about web software, web content, online material, creating or enabling communities. What I'm going to try and convince you is that that's true, but also very importantly goes the other way around. That in this new world of zero prices, if you want to have a sustainable way of creating content, you have to make a community. Let me give you just first a little bit of background. These thoughts have come from starting out heading Open Democracy, which I've now done for 6 months, and trying to understand how can we keep this going. Open Democracy started publishing in May 2001, and ever since then has built itself a real position on the web. If you type democracy into Google, you get Open Democracy at number 3. It's developed a position as being a commentator on world affairs, and a commentator with a particular kind of independence. It doesn't need to have advertising, so it doesn't need sensational stories. It isn't promoting anyone. It isn't in the pay of any foreign office, and therefore doesn't have a line that it needs to take. Its biggest virtue is its independence. But of course, the question comes back, well, if you're independent, and if content is free, then who pays for you? In general, online media is in a crisis, or rather, media overall, serious media, newspapers, magazines, etc., are in a state of crisis. Advertising revenue, the price of a page per viewer on printed media is falling. Subscriptions are falling. People are drowning in material. So whereas people used to take a subscription to something like Time or The Economist, they now just buy an occasional copy off the newsstand. Information is coming from everywhere. Internet content is mostly losing money. Most of the publications, most of the serious news publications that have a paper basis, mostly have free internet content. Quite sophisticated. You look at something like the New York Times, very, very sophisticated online publication. It doesn't recoup its money out of advertising. Of course, there are sort of new media, Google, MySpace, that are hugely profitable. But these are not publications like the New York Times. They're very useful, they're very good, they do a lot. But they certainly don't produce analysis, content at a consistent and high quality. Of course, copyright, we talk a lot about copyright being under threat. And copyright, it was thought, was one of the basis of the old media. You produced something, and you could sell the same thing millions of times over. The Economist magazine sells over 1 million copies a week. Now, the same thing sells 1 million times, and you can control that. You, the Economist, are the only one who can sell it. That's what copyright allows you to do. If you didn't have copyright, you'd sell one, someone go out and photocopy and sell it. That you'd have no control of your price. So the copyright is under threat, and obviously the most visible bit of that is the Motion Pictures Association of America being paranoid about in its belief that copyright is the basis for the music industry and the film industry, and therefore has spent a huge amount lobbying for strengthening of copyright, given that technology is undermining it. So, back to the original question. In the face of this general environment, what does it take to keep producing quality? Okay, so here's the business example, very broadly, of open democracy. So we publish around 1,500 articles per year. We mostly publish under Creative Commons attribute, non-commercial, no derivatives license. Do I need to go into what those things mean? So firstly, Creative Commons, set up by Lawrence Lessig, the Stanford law professor, who saw that somehow the old copyright was not no longer fitted the new digital reproduction or people's desires under it. And Lessig produced a number of draft licenses which people would easily be able to say, I don't want the full strength of copyright, I actually want people to be able to share my production, here are the standard licenses. Now, the particular standard license that we use is one which says, and of course the word, the name Creative Commons, so it's a very nice name. The commons refers to, in traditional agrarian European societies, the commons were the places where anyone could graze their cattle. So it wasn't enclosed. If you had a cow, you could just send your cow out onto the commons. There's something about sharing. And then it's a creative commons in the sense that this is the place where you can share what's needed for creation and what you have created. And this is the philosophy behind Creative Commons. Attribute means if you use it, if you reuse what's put out in the Creative Commons, then you attribute. You say who it was by. I'm using something by. So you've got one down here. This is the logo of Creative Commons, and this presentation is under Creative Commons. As it says, some rights reserved, unlike the usual copyright notice says all rights reserved. Non-commercial means that you can use this particular thing as long as you don't sell it. So I'm the only one, I reserve the right to be the only one who sells, who makes money out of it. And then no derivatives is the clause which says you have to use it in its entirety. You can't just, for example, in this particular, if I were licensing this one, this presentation under no derivatives, you wouldn't be able to take three slides and use just three slides. You would use the whole thing. Most of our authors of the 1,500 articles are happy to publish under attribution, non-commercial, no derivatives license. This, by the way, is known as the advertising license. If you want to advertise yourself, these are exactly the terms that you'd want. If you're more interested in people knowing about you than in making a lot of money from people knowing about you, then this is the license that you'd want. So, these 1,500 articles, the licensing means that it's free. People can copy it. Unlike the physical copy of The Economist, we're giving people the opportunity to copy, and it's free. What we have is engaged public intellectuals debating democracy, human rights, globalization. We have 1,500 authors or so who over the 6 years of Open Democracy's existence have contributed. And Open Democracy plays its part. There is a sort of global commons of debate on the important issues of the day, and Open Democracy is contributing its part to that public space. Now, it's actually quite expensive doing that. We need about $1.5 million to do that. So very round numbers, you'll see you need about $1,000 an article. Seems remarkable. We pay for almost none of these articles. We're not paying authors. And yet we still need $1.5 million to do this. We still need $1,000. Why do we need $1,000? Well, one of the things that surprised me, and I wasn't, but before this stint of heading Open Democracy, I didn't really know journalism except as a consumer. But journalism is a sort of brokerage business. What a newspaper does is it brings together ideas with minds. So in the world, it knows that there are people with ideas to share, to broadcast. It also knows that there are people who want those ideas. And what the newspaper does is it brings those together. And the act of bringing those together, it's like all brokerage. I mean, it's like real estate brokerage, which is saying, oh, well, you know, there are apartments out there and there are people who want them. And the skilled real estate broker, like the Second Life millionaire, the first real dollar Second Life millionaire, who just knew Second Life so well that she could just say, ah, you're looking for a piece of real estate to run a class in? Yes, I can find you it. You know, it's that level of, that's a huge skill, that brokerage skill. And in the context of a newspaper, that's the essence of the editorial. The editorial says, I can see that my readers are going to need a commentary this week, this month, this year. They're going to need commentary on this. I know the space of public intellectuals, and I know what will make a good set of commentaries about this. I'm going to bring this in. And of course, you bring it in, and like a real estate broker, you give some advice as to the people trying to rent the house or sell the house. You give them some advice that maybe they should put a few, you know, do a bit of paint and do something in the garden. Same thing with the article. You bring it in and you say, look, you've got to shorten it. You better make that point a bit clearer, etc. So the editorial function, it's a tough job. So even if you're not paying your authors, you have to put a lot of resources into editorial. And if you don't, you make something that's basically not consumable. You don't get. No one buys it. The other side of the equation doesn't work. So you need a whole editorial side. You need, of course, a technical side. I mean, we employ one full-time programmer. We employ a couple of people who basically know how to run the systems. And then, of course, because the operation needs revenues, and this is the point of the talk, I'll get on to the revenues. Because we need revenues, you need fundraising, so you need a fundraising team. And then, because the whole point of this brokerage operation is you're bringing ideas together with minds, you have to make sure that the minds know that you're there, and that's the marketing operation. You need a marketing operation which knows that you're publishing the quality material, comes to read it, and your authors need to know that you're bringing the right minds there. So that's why, even when you're not paying for your basic input, your basic raw material, that's why it still costs something. And this, by the way, is why the initiatives around citizen journalism are difficult to get right. They're difficult to get right because it's not enough gathering information. Newspapers aren't about gathering information. They're about this brokerage role, and that brokerage role is expensive. So if we don't get the $1.5 million, we join the rest of the crisis. We have to provide less, and in the extreme case, we don't exist at all. And then just again for background, let me show you where the money comes from today. This, very broadly, is where the money came from in 2006. By far the biggest portion of it comes from philanthropy. These are people, I'll get on to this later, these are people who think that what we're doing is worthwhile. Our membership donates 8% of our needed 1.5 million. These partnerships at 18% are... let me give you a good example. As good information brokers that understand the web, we developed a project to do something about environment and China, and it's called ChinaDialogue.net. And we were able to find a group of people who wanted China Dialogue, a conversation with China about the environment, to go on. And this is what I mean by partnerships. Things that editorial projects, which make sense to us and which we can find others to pay for. You'll see there's a remarkably small amount from advertising. I mean, part of it is that no one has spent enough time on selling advertising in open democracy. Part of it is the philosophy of independence. Again, back to the beginning of the talk, if you're supported by advertising, then you're going to start shaping your content to advertising. I'm not against advertising, I'm not against it. But there's a real tension. If you're selling, if your primary virtue, if your reason for being on the web, in the world, is independence, then it's something you have to guard. It's part of your brand. You have to guard it. And I don't know whether you remember this, probably not, but there were, you will remember when the French water maker Perrier, that had always advertised itself for its purity, got one of the machines broke down and started putting oil into the water, and the sales never recovered. It was a tarnishing of the brand. So I'm happy to do advertising. It generates very little money. But we do have to be careful in terms of what it does to our brand. What's interesting about advertising is that today all our advertising is Google AdWords, and if you read Wired magazine on these questions about content, if you read the web utopians on this, they will say Google AdWords will pay for everything. Google AdWords, interestingly, pay for very little. It's a separate topic, but just as a diversion, I think the reason is, so the way Google AdWords work is you give Google your page and you say this is the page, this is the kind, Google sends its spiders and says this is the kind of content on this page, and given this kind of content, Google has some software in the background that will choose some advertisements. And it'll choose the advertisements to maximize clicks. And the reason is that Google's clients pay Google for each click on the Google AdWord. So Google has an interest in serving the best ads. You have an interest in putting them in a good place on the page. You share the revenue with Google. Now, my belief is that when you go onto Google itself as the search engine and the paid ads appear on the right-hand side, the fact that you're searching means that you're in the position and the frame of mind to make a choice, a decision. You're thinking about where to go. So it's a very cognitive state. Where shall I go and find this information or this service? And therefore, when you're searching, Google gets lots of click-throughs. But if you've got to a destination on the web, if you're doing what it is you want to do, then you try and exclude everything else from your peripheral vision. And our click-through rate on Google Ads, I look at the Google Ads, they're not irrelevant, they're quite good, but our click-through rates are terrible. And that's because people aren't in a moment of choice. And so, hence this very, very small number. Okay, that's the background. So back to the question, which is, what exactly does it take to sustain production in the new media world? And in a way, what the body of the lecture that I'm coming up with is to explain why the numbers, the proportions I showed you on the previous page, even if they're not exactly right, why they are a kind of equilibrium, why they make sense. And the basic conclusion I want to get to is that you need a community to build a website. And throughout this, I like the analogy, the thought of spaces on the web, websites, being a little bit like public spaces and public gardens. And here, down in the bottom right, you probably can't see it very well. This is, I live in a bit of London that has a canal by it, and the canal has got a path, and this is an old motorcycle carcass that's been left down by the side of the canal. This is a public space that isn't working, right? It's pretty bad. And up here on the left hand side, we have the extreme of the well kept public space. This is a Chatsworth house, which is a nice country house in England, with its beautifully cared for lawns. And there are places in between that have lots of qualities, some places that people can meet in, other places that people play in. You have these places that clearly haven't quite worked, or that maybe once worked, paths through the wilderness that are now overgrown. So the question is, how does one make sure one creates a space that somehow lives in this bit of the world rather than down into this bit of the world? And let me just give you a few names, and this is how I'll tell the story. So firstly, I think absolutely seminal is The Long Tail, Bruce Anderson, an article in Wired, actually, in 1998, and then a book. The article, I think, says everything that the book says. So, and I'll just go through what The Long Tail means for us. And then I'll talk about Frank Ramsey and optimal pricing. And this was some work in Cambridge in the 1930s, which I think is relevant. And there's a bit of economics that's known as Ramsey-Boiteux pricing, which is about how you price things that are difficult to price in the sort of way we have here. And Boiteux was actually the Électricité de France economist in the 1950s, and then head of Électricité de France in the 1960s, had to work out how to put price on very cheap nuclear energy. It's rather like our problem, which is how to put a price on something that's basically zero cost. And this is all brought together by Pareto, the Italian sociologist of the turn of the century, who thought very hard about what prices should be. And I'll just mention what Pareto means in the context of zero prices. And then I've probably misspelled this, but I'll briefly talk about meaning and cost, costly signaling and the work at MIT in the 80s, Holmstrom. Then Hannah Arendt, who was Heidegger's Jewish mistress, I mean, an extraordinary intellectual partnership, but who wrote about public dialogue and public spaces, in particular a book called Human Action. And then I'll briefly mention Robert Nozick, who's a libertarian philosopher who wrote a book called Anarchy, State, and Utopia. And at least when I was at university reading these things, people read a lot the anarchy and the state part of it and rather forgot the utopia part of it. And I think that in some ways the utopia part of it is what's relevant to web communities today. So that's the tour d'horizon. Okay, here's the long tail. What I have on this graph is, so imagine what we collect is the amount of money that people spend on different types of media. So you've got, in this particular case, you've got an example of Shrek and blockbusters like it, getting a large percentage of the total spend of the typical consumer, or all consumers together. And so what you take is you take all the titles, take Shrek, all the way down to the, you know, to my own home YouTube movie, all the way down here, and you order them. You just sort them from the highest to the lowest. And what you'll get is a curve that looks a little bit like this. And what this curve says to you is something like, well, you know, 10% of titles get approximately 11% of budgets. And 75%, the 75th percent, the title that comes up right at the 75th point here, is getting just 2.5% of budgets. And the area under this whole curve is the total amount that's spent. So the long tail is this bit of the curve down here. What Anderson pointed out in 1998 was that the old media economics had very high costs. So to produce one Shrek, to produce one Titanic, to produce one copy, one weekly copy of The Economist, had very high fixed costs, but you could then sell lots and lots of copies. Now, what that meant was that as long as you could guarantee enough of a large enough percentage of the media spend on yourself, you produced it. But as soon as you got to a pretty low percentage of the media spend, you'd never get those costs back. So if Shrek was something that appealed only to us in this room, they'd never build it, right? Because it cost $100 million, and it appeals to us, but not that much. So there's a kind of blockbuster economy that's over here, and that relies on lots of people wanting the same thing. What Anderson said was, look, a lot of these costs are distribution costs, and these distribution costs go to zero in the internet. And to the extent that they're distribution costs or that self-build works, there's now going to be an economy all the way down here. Now, of course, the reality of Hollywood used to be they didn't know that they were going to get a Shrek or a Titanic. What they'd do is they'd build films for between, let's say, you know, $15 million for a low budget to $100 million for a high budget. They'd build these films in the hope that they would be up here. Of course, quite a few of them would be duds and would never survive. So we still got some media, we still got some content production, which almost no one looked at. There were lots of famous flops. Was it Waterworld?
Okay, anyway. Waterworld?
Yeah, exactly. So Waterworld, you know, ended up being here, but it was always with the hope of being here. What Anderson says is the internet changes the hit mentality of media production. We can now have an economy that lives over here. Now, of course, Anderson doesn't say, he does in his new book, it's less persuasive, at least as a concept, I haven't read it. Anderson doesn't say in The Long Tail that the cost of production has gone to zero. He just says that the cost of production is low enough, the cost of distribution is zero, the cost of one extra copy is zero, and therefore we can now have an economy here. And one way I like to think about the Anderson argument is there's a sort of, if you look at this curve, and people have built this curve for music, for books, etc., it does look more or less like this. It's symmetrical, right? Doesn't matter. You could flip the axes and it would look the same way. Now, if Hollywood can live in this bit here, then certainly someone can live in this bit here. The total revenue, the total willingness to buy, is the same in both cases. At least if you crack the problem of how you get paid. Now, one of the consequences of zero incremental costs, if an additional unit has zero cost, then there is a sense in which it's too cheap to meter. Too cheap to meter was something that in the 1960s and 70s in England, there was a lot of support for nuclear power. And I understand there's quite a lot of nuclear power in Japan. There was also opposition to nuclear power. And one of the slogans that the nuclear industry produced for nuclear power is it'll produce electricity that's too cheap to meter. The cost of putting a meter on it is too great. We're just going to be, you know, it is a world of abundance. So rather like the nuclear power station, once you've built it, it actually just keeps going. It's more expensive to not produce electricity than to produce. Once you've built the article, once you've produced the media, what has become clear since 1999 or so is that it is too cheap to meter. You can't get people to pay for it. The cost of an extra unit is zero. There's no incentive to get people to pay for it once you've built it. And, of course, this is compounded in the case of public intellectuals or any creative process at all, that whoever's behind the creative process, they want to be distributed. They want to be read. So anything that stops them, anything that stands in their way, is something that they dislike. Of course, they love the idea of being stars with large incomes. But what they hate even more is not being noticed. So, the question comes back to how do you finance the original production cost, the $1,000? Now, back to this electricity example, and this is where Boiteau-Ramsey pricing comes in. Okay, so this is what I now have is what I think of as the economics of a single article at OD. And I'll do the numbers first. What I'm trying to measure is what should be called here willingness to pay, if it were all on the same screen. What I'm doing is I'm taking all the people in the world, people and institutions in the world, and I'm saying for each of them, how much are they willing to pay for this one article on Scottish devolution, on open democracy, for example. And I find that there's one person in the world or one institution in the world who's prepared to pay $700. It's not that they do pay, they would pay. If I could see into their souls, they would pay $700. That's the concept I'm after. The second highest valuer will pay $200. The third highest will pay $100. I've found three people who in total, by the way, will pay $1,000 in the whole world. And then I get into the people who like it but don't like it that much, a bit like us with Shrek. There are 100 people, or between 3 and 100. The 97 people will pay $1, would pay $1. There are 100 people between 100 and 200 who'll pay 30 cents, etc. This is how I'm building this concept of willingness to pay, total willingness to pay for a single article. And I can represent this as a graph, which is what I do here, except to make it fit onto this screen. Notice this goes 1, 2, 3, 100, 200, 500, 1,000. So this is the willingness to pay, this column here, and this is the number of people. Now, if I were able to extract from everyone in the world the willingness to pay for this article, what I would be able to get would be the area under this graph. Okay, that's exactly the same as just the sum that I'm computing here. So in other words, you know, this article is worth $1,237 to the world. And actually, it costs $1,000 to produce on average. Somehow, its existence in the world is good. It creates more value than it destroys. The question is how to find it. So why are there people right up here at the top prepared to pay substantial amounts for it? Well, there are people prepared to pay substantial amounts. They're advertisers, philanthropists, and interested parties, basically. Advertisers are prepared to pay, might be prepared to pay, because you're delivering to them minds that they can then convince to buy something. Philanthropists are prepared to pay because you're doing something, you're having an impact, which they support, which they think is good. And the interested parties are prepared to pay because, rather like the advertisers, they're trying to promote a particular end. So in all these cases, for all of them, they will pay. This block of revenue here is available if you deliver minds. You have to deliver minds to get here. And these ones here, they are too cheap to meter. You know, these ones, they're only just willing to pay. If you put a little bit of resistance in their way, they'll go away. That's what we've seen on the internet. Everyone has tried running subscription models, and very few people succeed. So these are your readers. They are minds. And they're minds if you don't ask them to pay too much. So there's something intriguing that's coming along in this picture of the economics of an article, which is that here's your willingness to pay, and these people are willing to pay as long as you make this free. Now, there's both an opportunity and a danger here, which is, well, if you make it free, then these people don't think they need to pay. There's an opportunity, of course, which is if you can deliver the readers, then you can get these people to pay something like their willingness. Now, back to Ramsey's rule. So Frank Ramsey was a Cambridge Cambridge mathematician of the 30s. He's very there's a really wonderful obituary that Keynes wrote of Frank Ramsey. Ramsey died at the age of 32 or 33 or something, and he made important contributions in maths, and he wrote two articles in economics, made very important contributions in economics with those two articles. He was clearly an astonishing person and died very young. So what Ramsey was asking is a very important question in the 1930s and continues to be an important question. It was, well, if, let's say, a public sector is supplying goods, then how should it price them so that it can cover their costs? So it was because of the attraction in the 1930s of finding a way of getting social democracy to work. In other words, not having nationalization on the scale that was being seen in the Soviet Union, but still having a very active and involved public sector. There was this question of making sure that you could still pay for the goods. What was the best, most efficient way of paying for the goods? And what Ramsey showed was that you should get people to pay in proportion to their willingness to pay. So it kind of sounds very fair, and in some ways the nice thing is that it sounds fair, but it also is very efficient. It's very close to being as efficient as you can get. And the reason is that when you're thinking about, let me go back to this, if you're thinking about a pricing rule here, what you want to do when you're recovering revenues is you want to try and have as little impact as possible on what people do. You're just trying to get the revenue. You don't want to stop anyone from doing anything. And here, you know that if you start getting prices, if you start trying to recover revenues here, people are going to stop reading. You're going to change the way they behave. Whereas if you start asking for prices here, you don't change the way they behave. So there's a sort of funny way in which what Ramsey's rule says is take advantage of those who really want it. So it's a bit of fairness, but it's also, in a way, a kind of power play, because these people, you've got power over these people because they really want what you're going to give them. And what Ramsay says, well, take advantage of that power. And Watteau then, in the 1950s, turned this into electricity tariffs in imaginative ways. And the notion of having as little effect as possible on what people do when you set a price is what's known as Pareto efficiency. Under Pareto efficiency, what you want is to make sure that you only charge just so much that stops the resources going to any alternative use. Now, in the particular case of our article, there's a twist to Ramsay's rule, and I think I've previewed it. So we had three people in that example who had a high willingness to pay, but they had a high willingness to pay for the consumption of others, for the consumption of the others. It wasn't their own consumption in a way. It was their willingness to pay was conditional on everyone else consuming it. So the difficulty from the point of view of a business here is we know we have philanthropists who believe that we might be doing something good, that we might be having the kind of impact that they want. But the question that they will always have is, are they actually having that impact? Do they really deliver these minds? It's very difficult, it's a very impalpable thing, right? So the problem that we end up with is this one, which is how do we prove that we supply good minds? What is a good mind? Well, whether you're an interested party, an advertiser, or a philanthropist, you need to be open. You know, the advertiser wants you to be open to the subliminal message. The philanthropist wants you to be open to whatever it is they're promoting, in our case, democracy, justice, human rights. In our particular case, we have to show that people are ready to be influenced by ideas and dialogue if we want to select the kind of philanthropist we want. And identifiable demographic segment. I think this is quite an important one, actually, for all of these. We have to be able to say, who are we influencing? Our particular demographics are sort of odd because we have students, retired people, and professionals in about equal proportion. And for an internet publication, this is odd. Most internet publications, you know, MySpace, very few retired people on it. And then, you know, specialist cruises, very few students on them. So we're relatively unique in having this broad cross-section, but we've got to be able to say to philanthropists or to advertisers, this is who we have, this is whose minds you have, and therefore we will be changing, having an impact in the world in this way or that way. So the problem is, how do we prove that we're delivering good minds? One of the favorite measures is clicks. How many page views do you get? It's a kind of basic measure. There's a service at alexa.com. It's an online service where you type in any two or three websites and it'll tell you how many users per million are accessing it. Extremely easy, very broad, but the trouble is that a click is cheap. What I mean by that is that it doesn't cost a user very much. You know, we could increase clicks by, for example, buying some Google AdWords, get Google Ads to be on the right-hand side of Google. If we could buy, for a week after the execution, we could have bought Saddam Hussein, and we would have got a torrent of clicks. Okay, now, clicks are therefore cheap. They don't convey very much information. And this is where I bring in Holmstrom cheap talk, which I think is very important, a really critical, crucial concept here, which is that a signal is only really worth the amount that it costs to produce. And if for a few hundred dollars I can produce tens of thousands of clicks, page views, then this is not going to prove to anyone that I'm supplying good minds. And there's a sense, therefore, that, you know, the click contaminates, the cheapness of the click contaminates page views. I can't say to my philanthropist, I've got 1 million readers. I can say it. It's not persuasive as a measure of a good mind. So, here's what you need to show that you've delivered a mind, not a click. Has the reader given you time? That's the first bit of cost. Do the readers actually discuss things? Do the readers comment? Do the readers donate? These become events which one can suddenly talk about as being significant and being investments. These are things which actually cost the user something. I'm reminded of what Hannah Arendt writes about the creation of public spaces. Public spaces for her are places that we invest in. We create a public realm by joining in it, investing in it, spending time in it, discussing in it. That's what creates the public realm, and that's what allows us to be properly free and, in her view, together to exercise power. So these sorts of things which we have to demonstrate to those with the willingness to pay are the sorts of things which Hannah Arendt describes as being the necessary conditions for creating a public space. And of course, back to Holmstrom's signaling, for the third party, for the person looking at you, it's if you invest in something, if something is costly or difficult to you, that's when it becomes meaningful, at least in terms of interpreting your behavior. So I think we more or less get to my conclusion that it takes a community to build content on the web. Those investments that readers make, once they've made those investments, they're really no longer readers. They've become joint creators. They've become members, not readers. If you start discussing something and that discussion is open to everyone and is part of the content, you're no longer just a reader. And this is the process of readers becoming members. And once you've become a member, you start participating in the joint creation. This really hit home to me when I was... This is 2001. I was in Silicon Valley. I'd moved there to move Arithmetica. And I was recruiting engineers. And you'd get engineering CVs. And then from time to time, particularly the good CVs, they would say other interests, /.karma positive. Do you know /.? No? So /.  is this wonderful, wonderful technology site. And it's a discussion forum. It's got a lot of energy. People debate there in the kind of way that Hannah Arendt would have found absolutely wonderful. So one of the most energetic online forums. Also very high quality, I think, in lots of ways. And part of getting the quality on /.  is a system of community reputation. And the community reputation is if you do things that help the overall community on /.  For example, if you rate articles, you're occasionally asked to rate an article, if you rate responses, if you rate people, a little bit like doing the weeds in one of these public spaces, if you do the weeds in one of the public spaces, then your karma goes up. If you start off a good debate, your karma goes up, etc. Now, what struck me was that the engineers I was interviewing, for these engineers, /.  and their role on /.  their position on /.  their standing in the /.  community had become an important enough part of their lives that it was on their CVs. It was like, whatever other interests you put down, ski champion or whatever, for them, it was /.  karma. And this suddenly said to me, /.  has succeeded in doing something here which is truly remarkable, which is it has made people feel a sense of membership around this online community, which very few sites, I think, do. And certainly very few sort of serious discursive sites do. I think that's probably an important qualifier. Now, this makes me think of is this book here, Robert Nozick's Anarchy, State, and Utopia. This was written in the 1970s in the US, and a lot of this bit, Anarchy and State, it was really written as a reply to John Rawls, and it was really about the role of the state in our day-to-day affairs. But the third part of it, the last part of it, is his section on Utopia. in which he says, well, all this is all a bit dry and it's all, you know, it's an argument against. I want to talk about why I think my version, my brand of anarchy, is good. And, you know, I think it's utopian what he writes, but there are things which are quite striking for the web, I think, about it, which is that he describes a world of many voluntary overlapping communities that sustain their members and their members' meanings through their joint behavior. He thinks that this is possible as a mode of organization in our physical lives. I think he's wrong. But I think that as a mode of organization in our virtual lives, he may be right. And, of course, in his picture of it, you have self-defined groups living voluntary taxes and allowed to exist alongside others. Now, what I had up here in the kind of the summum of defining to a philanthropist that I have someone who really cares, it is a reader that's willing to be subjected to voluntary taxation, that's donating to a site. Back to my pictures of gardens to wrap up. We talked about creative commons, we talked about public spaces. There's a very famous allegory of the tragedy of the commons. And the tragedy of the commons is usually talked about by environmental economists to describe what happens when you don't give people responsibility for their own little bit of something. So the usual story is this. Maybe fishing is a good example, particularly in a fishing nation like Japan, which is that the fish belong to everyone. And each individual fisherman goes out in a fishing boat, catches fish, and has very little impact on the total sustainability of his catch. It's a diluted effect. His own impact on whether there are going to be enough fish next year, given what he's caught, is minuscule. He knows if he doesn't catch these fish, someone else will catch those fish. He knows that even if someone else doesn't catch those fish, he has almost no impact on his own. There's a diluted effect. Now, for environmental economists, there's a tragedy of the commons. The tragedy of the commons is if no one owns it, then it gets overexploited. So, in some sense, what we've been talking about, what the long tail, what zero price is, what Ramsey pricing says, is that there's not just a tragedy of the commons. We can understand that tragedy of the commons in the environmental context. There's also what we'd like to call a comedy of the commons, which is, if you can get it right, there are certain types of goods that really have zero incremental cost. The trouble with the fish is that his catching doesn't have, it has zero cost to him, an extra catch, but it has a positive cost to everyone else. What we've been describing are communities where there's zero cost to an additional consumer, and there's a positive effect in terms of community and participation from that behavior. So what we want to move is, we want to make sure that we're not part of the tragedy of the commons, which was here, the motorbike, in the common space that no one cares about, and that we move towards the comedy of the commons, to that space that becomes cared for and jointly produced. So the tragedy of the commons is one which comes about where you think that the consequences are only mine, where I don't identify with this space. If I thought that this canal side, even if it were public, were part of me, in the sense that the engineers thought that Slashdot was part of them, I would not let that continue. I would somehow get neighbors together to try and do something about it. And I won't have a measurable impact, is again part of the thinking which leads to the tragedy of the commons rather than the comedy of the commons. And the comedy of the commons is what we together create matters. Our joint creation is good. We have to see that it's good for us to want to be able to continue to invest in it. And there's, you know, always room for ego in this. I want to see myself reflected in the endeavor. Again, like the engineer on Slashdot. The engineer on Slashdot was telling me, the employer, that part of the aura of Slashdot was being reflected in them by having a positive karma. There we go. How we hope that it might be possible to move from the tragedy to the comedy of the commons in the context of open democracy. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Tony. You talked about how important it is to get readers involved and to make them feel part of the community. And going back to your slide on the revenue sources, you said that members are contributing 8% of your revenues. Now, possibly you can't tell us how many people that actually is, but I was wondering if you're seeing the numbers of people who are actually donating, if you're seeing those numbers rise in response to maybe new community features on your website, or you know what, if you're seeing these ideas that you've had in the last 6 months actually paying off in terms of more donating readers.
So you've sort of gone straight to my to what the to as it were the action plan. because I've been very slow, but you're exactly right, this is where I'm focusing. My plan for open democracy is to get this number up. There are a few other key numbers that I need to get up. One of the fascinating numbers, I didn't have it on me to show you, is the distribution of time spent. So we find that 40% of our viewers spend less than 30 seconds per visit on Open Democracy. Now, if you've seen Open Democracy, you'll realize that 30 seconds, you haven't got much of Open Democracy in 30 seconds. You know, and then we have another hump at 4 minutes or so. So in a sense, yes, I'm after all those increased ways of showing investment. The community features thing is interesting. I mean, firstly, just on a sort of boringly technical point, we've been moving the platform. We had a very old platform which I just needed to ditch to be able to implement some of the new style community features. Haven't done yet. Going slow. Always does. but I'm quite interested to think about it. We did a reader survey. I mean, I'm interested to know what community features are the right community features. In some sense, I believe that my I'd like to see some of the features of Slashdot, of the Slashdot community reproduced on Open Democracy. And in particular, the energy of the discussion, I think, is fantastic. One of the big reasons, I think, that the energy of the discussion on Slashdot is so good, and so much better than places like Digg. I mean, I sort of think of, I don't know whether you probably, Digg is another very popular technology site, but Digg is a sort of populist site. Slashdot has real quality. the reason I think, one of the things that Slashdot does, which I think is very intelligent, is that people comment. I'm sure you've been on to these places where the commentary is basically dull. And in a way, the reason the commentary is dull is that it's not edited. Right? This whole process of turning thoughts into something that's consumable is quite difficult. Now, Slashdot invites people to rate comments, and if your comments are not rated enough, then they get collapsed into just the title. So there's something terrible for the ego there. You know, most people are commenting, and you know, at least in part, because they want to project themselves. And if they've tried to project themselves, and they project themselves in such a way that they get diminished, then you know that disciplines them. That disciplines their behavior. I think that one of the impressive things about Slashdot is the discipline of the conversation. And
when you read it, there are often 50 or 100 comments, so very few people, casual readers, will actually expand all the collapsed comments. They usually just get ignored. And then as you scroll down, you'll have one that's expanded for you to read, and it'll have informative or interesting, because somebody's rated that.
Yeah. So we're actually just in the process of doing a... We have a two-dimensional scoring scheme. Sort of inspired by this, what I have got developed is a scheme that goes something... I'm not sure what... We haven't decided on the words yet, but it's going to be something like this, and then... I have terrible handwriting, I apologize. But I have two dimensions of scoring. Slashdot has many more, has about five dimensions, but Slashdot also has the advantage that it has such a geeky readership that they don't mind all the difficulty navigating it. We don't. So you have a comment to someone else's comment or to an article, etc. Like-dislike is about your attitude to the content. And the way we're doing it is that the more likes there are, the higher the contrast between the text and the background. And if you get to dislikes, if you get a lot of dislikes, you'll have grey on grey. And then good for debate, bad for debate is meant to be, look, is this, you know, for example, things that are too long, things that are offensive, all these things which are about the nature of debate rather than about the content itself. And these are going to be Slashdot-like in that each bad for debate is going to reduce your space by 1 point. So that's certainly one of the things I'm implementing to try and increase the quality of the debate on Open Democracy.
And how do you implement grey on grey from an accessibility standpoint for visually handicapped people?
Well, I think it's part of the punishment of producing boring copy is that you, in fact, you're doing the handicapped a favour by making it inaccessible.
Do you have any comments or questions? Yeah, Kim-san.
I have a simple question, and probably it comes from the my shallow understanding about the long tail, concept of long tail. So could you just show me the long tail slide, please? Yeah, thank you. I'm just wondering if our economy goes to all the way down there, that point, the over 75%, yeah, and then... Does it mean like the producer who makes like a blockbuster, or like they just want to invest a lot of money, a great number of money to their products, and they just lose their motivation to make that sort of things, and consequently, meaning we just lose our chance to watch that sort of like really big project or blockbuster movie or something like that.
I think. One needs to separate out, it's a good question, but one needs to separate out, or it's useful to separate out supply and demand. Okay, so if it continues to be the case that there's kind of a worldwide desire to see Shrek, and that, you know, almost all children want to see it, then you're still going to be in a world in which that kind of project can support a cost of $100 million. Right, because a dollar per child, or, you know, whatever, it's going to be, you're going to be able to support it. So that's the demand side. But I think that there's an interesting, and maybe this is what you were thinking about, I think there's an interesting way in which the existence of the long tail here means that our preferences change, or what we know about our preferences change. So maybe we all watch the Football World Cup, and we all watch the Olympics, and we all watch Shrek, because there are hundreds of millions of dollars spent on it, right? Rather than there are hundreds of millions of dollars spent on it because that's what we all have in common and want. So as there are more and more hours of the day are spent consuming here, there are fewer and fewer hours in the year that can be devoted to this. And I think that's, I mean, I think that's a wonderful development myself, that the long tail competes with the blockbuster end. Well, you have to hope that there are enough people like you to sustain your tastes. I think that, you know, that's the general lesson, isn't it? I mean, it's like skiing. I don't know if you ski. I ski. I mean, if you imagine, if you were the only person in the world who liked skiing, there'd be no skiing equipment, right? It wouldn't be worth producing for me. So you have to hope that your community of interest is just large enough to maintain its needs.
I'm sure you're aware of the Korean website Oh My News. I'm wondering what your impression is of that. I mean, I haven't researched it, but my understanding, Kim Sam is from Korea, so he can tell us more. My understanding is that essentially the people writing the content, they don't get paid, but if their story is voted or rated very highly, it appears on the front page, and then they do get some financial incentive.
Right.
Is there also... Of course, your authors are completely voluntary, right?
Some are paid. I mean, our basic policy is if you write for a living and we commission you, then we'll pay you some what we can afford. Mm. But if you're an academic or a professional or an NGO, you probably want to get heard. And so we won't. And it's also not what you get your income from. But Oman News, I agree, is very interesting, but it has a very professional editorial staff. Yeah. So I think that, I mean, in a way, it's very similar in that what it does is it's seen that the essence of the newspaper is the editorial staff, which is professional in Oman News, and the content, the stories, even some of those editorial decisions, like what appears on the front page. But the decisions as to what appears where is editorial, not voting-driven, I think, on Oman News. Is that right?
I'm not really sure, I mean, how the system has changed or not, but yeah, I think so. I mean, there's some editorial, some writing on there, and people read it, people usually read it, and people comes to like that writing, and then people vote it.
Yeah.
And then the writing, gathers a lot of, I mean, good voting, and then they get earn more money.
So there are extreme versions like Dig. Mm-hmm. So Dig, your position on the Dig front page depends on the number of digs you've got. So you know, one of the sort of fundamental editorial decisions is, you know, the way in which this whole process we've been talking about, you know, taking content and matching it with people, matching it with minds, in Dig is turned into a voting game. There's no editorial control. And I think Oman News doesn't do that. I think that Dig is unreadable. I don't know whether any of you like or read Dig. It's unreadable because it's very predictable, populist. You know all the sorts of automatic reactions that people are going to have. You know what's going to rise to the top of Dig. The individuality, the interest, the angle is lost in the voting. I think it's quite interesting.
Now, the other question that occurs to me about building a community and debating in the context of opendemocracy.net is that almost all of the stories, by definition, are extremely controversial and often are international disputes or ethnic disputes and topics about which it's very difficult to have a discussion that doesn't degenerate very quickly into name-calling or hate speech, etc. I mean, I think the English Wikipedia items on the disputed islands disputed between China and Japan, Chinese and Japanese people, you know, delete each other's entries every few minutes or hours, apparently. You know, it's a battleground. And obviously Wikipedia has its own policies for making it more difficult for people to edit their entries. And I'm just wondering what your experiences so far have been on your website of, you know, how to moderate debate or control it, you know, how to implement ground rules and how you see in your attempt to deepen or extend your communities, you know, how you're going to deal with those issues.
Yeah, those are good questions, and I think it becomes very clear, as you say, that in a way, if you can even start a dialogue, if you can start a debate, it almost means that you don't have a problem, right? Because to be able to talk in a constructive way about a problem already means that you're in a frame of mind in which you're thinking about the other person. So if you can do that, then, you know, the rest in a way is, you know, the rest is haggling. I mean, that's absolutely right. That's absolutely true. Over the years, the forums on Open Democracy are quite active, but they've tended to be, it's quite a small closed community over the years that has made the forums theirs. In those forums, we occasionally have to delete posts. It's very interesting, this question about not only about free speech and about rights, but about what is something that creates that public space of debate. And there are some things which are beyond acceptability, that are within your rights to say, but that are beyond acceptability in terms of how you treat people. And we certainly delete, and we're happy to delete, and it's by, at the moment, you can report a comment, or it's by editorial decision to delete. To some extent, I hope that this scheme will help in that there'll be a certain amount of community self-policing. But I think that even with community self-policing, you have to be prepared to say there are rules. Now, with that, when we talk to philanthropists about impact, some of the best stories that we have are stories of posters in the forums who started off posting in unacceptable ways, but who over the years have become members of the talking community. And that, in a way, is success. And that's real progress, because you start off with people who are out beyond the pale. And because the community of dialogue is attractive enough, they change what they do, they change what they write, and presumably they change what they think. So I think it's important as well not to sort of have, you know, knee-jerk reactions to the hateful speakers, because in a way, they're also an opportunity.
Tony, thank you very much again
thank
for
you.
Coming out here.
And great. Thank you very much.
It's certainly been interesting for me, and I hope for the rest of you as well. So thank you.
Thanks.